Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Tate Modern. My name is Marco Daniel. I'm curator of public programs, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you here today for this conference, Cy Twombly and New Perspectives. It's a particular honour, actually, to have this conference so soon after the opening of the exhibition, which means that we've got a really fabulous cast of speakers assembled. I'd just like to introduce you a little bit to the wider kind of logistical side of this conference. We've got three papers, three presentations in the morning, followed by a generous lunch break. During this lunch break, we would encourage you to take your conference tickets and see the exhibition if you haven't already done so. It's a really beautiful show. And, of course, it will also be really good for you just to remind yourselves of the actual works that we will have discussed here in the morning, particularly in the three papers and in the roundtable discussion after those. Then in the afternoon, we've got two more papers, tea break served in the Star Auditorium foyer, final presentation followed by the second roundtable discussion of the day. And that will conclude our day. The speakers we have, of course, are really exciting. We're starting with Nicholas Sirota, who is the director of Tate and curator, together with Nicholas Cullinan, of this exhibition. The second speaker of the morning is Alex Potts, who's Max Luhr Collegiate Professor in Art History at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He's the author of many books on sculpture recently and on various other aspects of modern and contemporary art, but also the author of the outstanding Flesh and the Ideal, Winkelmann and the Origins of Art History. Kate Nissen, the final speaker of the morning session, is a PhD candidate at Princeton University who is working on Cy Twombly sculptures. We're really pleased, in fact, that we have two PhD candidates presenting here today. It's an indication of the amazing interest that there is currently in Twombly's work and the timeliness of this exhibition. Carol Nigro, the second PhD candidate, is speaking in the afternoon. She is completing her dissertation on Cy Twombly's Histories and Myths, Humanist Vision in Contingent Times. Mary Jacobus, the second speaker of the afternoon, is Professor of English and Director of the Center for Research in Arts, Social Sciences, and Humanities at Cambridge University. She has written widely on Romanticism, Feminism, Psychoanalysis, Literary Theory, and the Visual Arts, and will present a very interesting perspective on Twombly's work that goes beyond the art historical and, art critical dimensions that we are looking at in some of the other papers. The final speaker of the afternoon, after the tea break, will be Thomas Crowe, who is the Rosalie Solo Professor of Modern Art History at the Institute of Fine Arts, New York. He is, of course, well known to all of you as a contributing editor of Art Forum, who has published a huge number of books and articles on all aspects of modern contemporary art. I'd now like to take the opportunity to hand over to Nicholas Cullinan, who's the assistant curator of the show and who will present a little bit more of an introduction to the exhibition and conference.
Good morning, and thanks so much for coming. I just wanted to begin by saying that right from the beginning of the exhibition, I think one of our central ambitions was to have this conference. And that's because of the unique circumstances of Twombly and his reputation, which is that obviously he's an artist who's very well known. He has a career spanning now almost 60 years, and there's been some fantastic writing on him. And I was just surveying the kind of roll call of authors who have written on Twombly, and it's obviously quite impressive. You have Frank O'Hara, Charles Olson, famously Roland Barthes, David Sylvester, Kirk Varnado, Giorgio Agamben, Hubert de Miche. I could continue. There's many, many more. But one thing that's interesting is when you read these writings and when you read the discussion around Twombly, it's often on a sort of ad hoc basis. And so there hasn't really been a sustained discussion around his work. And this is for probably many factors that will be unpicked today. I think one of these is that writing on Twombly is never particularly easy. The work is quite elusive and also allusive. And he's also not someone that's particularly welcomed writing on him. He's quite shy and doesn't particularly engage in the discussion around his work. So I think in doing this exhibition, we were really keen not just to, you know, have the exhibition, have the catalogue, but to really try to act as a catalyst to move the debate forward. And so we're really delighted today to have such a fantastic lineup of speakers, both established people who've written on him before and around this context, and also new research. So we're very pleased today to be doing this. This morning we'll be covering different areas. Alex Potts, for example, will touch on the sort of American-European aspect and dialogue between Twombly's work. And then Kate Neeson will talk about his sculptures, which have existed in a vacuum for so many years. There's still much to unpick. But to introduce the first speaker, one thing that we wanted to do in the catalogue was to have a young artist responding to his work. And Tasta Dean, who did a very beautiful essay in the catalogue, she gave a talk at DIA several years ago on Twombly. And so we asked her to turn that talk into an essay, which she very kindly did. And in the discussions with us about the essay, it transpired that she saw the Whitechapel show in London in 1987 as a student. It's still quite a sort of formative point in her career. And this was her first contact with Twombly. And so I think it's quite fitting that the first speaker is the person responsible for that show in 1987 and this show. And so I'd like to welcome Nicholas Rota.
Nick, thank you for that introduction. I'm not giving a paper. I'm going to try and set the scene for the rest of the conference by trying to give you some insight into the way in which we went about making this exhibition, which many of you have not yet had an opportunity to see. And I'm therefore going to begin by a very brief description, showing a few slides of the show, because frankly, if you haven't seen the show, you don't really want to sit here for 3 hours guessing what it might contain. As I think is evident from the title of the show, we have, and I will go on to talk a little more about this later as to why we went about it in this way, but we've decided not to do, as it were, a conventional retrospective, but nevertheless to cover the whole career with a series of groups of work. There are indeed 12 rooms in the show. They cover painting, work on paper, and sculpture. I'll explain later exactly why we went about it in that way, but broadly speaking, of course, the show begins at that moment when Twombly was first in New York in the early 50s, having learned a craft in Lexington and then in Boston. He was in New York meeting artists and in particular, of course, becoming a close friend of Robert Rauschenberg. And visiting the studios of de Kooning, but also seeing new work both from Europe and America in the galleries. And this painting from 1951, which is the first painting in the show, obviously betrays an interest in European art. It betrays clearly the association, if you know, of course, Rauschenberg's black paintings, Rauschenberg's own obsessions of that moment. And then Rauschenberg, as everyone, I think, here will be aware, Rauschenberg and Twombly went to Italy and then to North Africa in 1952 and looked at rock carvings and other work in North Africa and also in Italy and produced these remarkable paintings, many of which, or these two, for instance, were lost for many, many years and only reappeared in the late 80s. And so in the early shows of Twombly's work in the 70s and 80s, these were not part of the story. They were simply known from black and white photographs. Twombly began as a maker of objects as much as a painter, and he was unusual in that respect and unusual also in working almost, devoting almost equal attention to sculpture and to painting during the early part of his career. Twombly served in the army in 1953-54, and during that period he produced a series of drawings that followed the principles of surrealist automatic writing. and drawing, and then developed, when he came back to New York, this series of paintings that are highly calligraphic and in a way mark the beginning of what one might regard as a Twombly's signature work. You move into the second room, where Twombly has moved, as everyone will be aware, I think, here, to Italy. In 1957, he left America, not definitively, but he based himself in Italy, and immediately the work takes on a new character, partly influenced, of course, by the qualities of light in Italy, but also new interest on his part, and an increasing sense of colour begins to come into the work. And you see it in paintings like Arcadia here. The first cycle in the exhibition is this magnificent group of 24 poems to the sea, made one summer in 1959. They speak of Twombly's increasing absorption with issues to do with light. The calligraphic marks are evident but buried in paint, and they mark really a very significant moment, I think, in the career. And although they've been shown from time to time and indeed published, they've generally not been included in the in what might call, one might call the big exhibitions. As you move into the third room, we move into what would be regarded, I suppose, as quintessential Twombly. Paintings made in Rome in the early 60s, calligraphic, containing references to classical myth, to classical architecture, to increasingly scatological subject matter, penises, anuses, vaginas, sex generally, and lots of it, and blood. And you see it in this group. School of Athens, reference obviously to the Raphael School of Athens, Empire of Flora to Poussin. At this moment he was very much concerned, of course, with the classics. And then you come to the fourth room, the Ferragosto paintings made in 1 month, a very scorching August month, when he was remained in Rome and made this extraordinary group of paintings which have not been reunited since they were made in 1961, but they are sitting upstairs in the gallery. Towards the end of the 60s, Twombly made a group of paintings in Bolsena one summer. There were, I think, 16, of which we have five. These, again, colour is beginning to ebb from the work at this moment. They're paintings which unusually carry within them a reference to a contemporary event, namely the Apollo moon landing in 69, with which Twombly and, I suppose, many other people became obsessed that summer. And then you turn a corner in the show and come to these two great veil paintings. They were painted in 68 and 70. They come at a moment when Twombly was perhaps least appreciated, and certainly least appreciated in America. He had shown a magnificent cycle of paintings called The Discourse of Commodus, nine paintings, not in this exhibition, but they will be seen in Bilbao. And he'd shown them in 1964 at Leo Castelli's. He'd not shown in New York for some years, but they arrived in New York at the moment when the mood had changed very dramatically from an interest in painterly work, whether it be post-abstract expressionist or indeed the great masters of abstract expressionism, into a moment when pop and minimal were in the ascendant. And the show was famously and fiercely reviewed by Donald Judd. The person who has the phone on is me, actually. I'm really sorry about this. And it's in that jacket over there, so they'll have to just... whoever it is will have to suffer. Anyway, Twombly, I think was really quite shaken by the response to the work in 1964, and he went back in on himself and returned, as I think he has done at certain points in the career, to earlier concerns and interests. He went back to a painting that he'd made in 1955, which indeed was white on a dark ground, a very large painting called Panorama, again, not in the show, but I think quite well known. And it was a painting which, again, partly had been influenced by his association with Rauschenberg. But he went back to this idea of working from in light, out of dark, and began in 1966 with a series of what I suppose we would now regard as rather minimalist paintings in their character, very much concerned with drawing, very much concerned with measurement. And in these two paintings on the Treatise on the Veil, which were inspired by, or the starting point for which, was a photograph by Edward Muybridge given to Twombly by Bob Rauschenberg, concerned, of course, with the idea of rhythm and passage of Mark across the canvas. A couple of drawings that are associated, or three drawings that are associated with those two paintings. This room contains four out of the five paintings made in 1971. Twombly was continuing to paint what are familiarly known as the blackboard paintings, but he then moved to this group of paintings made shortly after the death, unexpected and early death, of a very close friend, the wife of his gallerist. And they are paintings which, as you will see, are informed by his sense of mourning. They are undoubtedly grow from, we know him at that point to have been looking very closely at the deluge drawings of Leonardo, and certainly the nature of the marks, the way in which he's working here. It's a new development for him, but it's also one which bears some interesting comparisons, I think, with Renaissance and classic draftsmanship. As we move into the mid-70s, we give way to a room which is primarily devoted to sculpture. Twombly, I mentioned, and as you saw, made sculpture from an early moment in his career. But then between 1959 and 1976, he made no sculpture at all. I think that if you look at the work that he was doing in the early 70s, he'd reached something of an impasse in his painting, although there was one great and magnificent cycle that was created in 77-78, 50 Days at Ilium. But he turned his mind to sculpture. It was a moment when he also went back and began to spend more time again in Lexington, Virginia, where he had grown up. And these sculptures, as you will see, began again with a very minimal approach to the use of materials. Boxes found in markets or in malls or on the street. The first sculpture, of course, made of two cardboard tubes pushed together and then covered with white gesso. His Orpheus sculpture relates very much to paintings that he had made or was making in the late 70s as well. And as many people have remarked, of course, these sculptures, following particularly the Ninis painting, can be seen very much as funerary monuments. We know that Twombly is fascinated by both Etruscan and Egyptian sculpture and architecture. In the early 80s, of course, Twombly moved on, and the paintings assume an increasingly watery character, more liquid. Turner became a figure of significance for him at this moment. And the whole notion of being close to the sea, close to water, the Mediterranean, these three sculptures in the exhibition, which are connected to the idea of a bark or a boat or a vessel, whether it be on the sea or crossing the River Styx, in any event, a fragile object which is used to transport both goods and also the soul. And towards the end of the 80s, Trombley completed this group of paintings shown at the Venice Biennale in 1988, evident associations with Tiepolo and Rococo painting generally, obviously connections in most people's minds with Monet, but a group of paintings which sit in the De Menil Museum or the De Menil Pavilion devoted to Trombley in Houston and have not been seen otherwise for 20 years or more. The penultimate room is given over to the two cycles on the theme of the Four Seasons, one of which will be familiar to you because it belongs in the Tate's collection, the other comes from MoMA in New York. Again, with some sculpture made at much the same time. And then finally, three of these great paintings on the theme of Bacchus, shown for the first time in 2005. 3 meter high paintings, 5 meters wide, in this rich wine color. So I think we can go back to, that's it. You can take off the slides now, actually. Yeah, thanks. The show, as I've suggested, is a show which looks at Trombley from a somewhat different point of view and from a very particular point of view. And I suppose the starting point for the show was the realization that Trombley has been quite well served by the exhibitions that have taken place over the last 25 or 30 years. Most of those exhibitions have had a very, in a way, a rather similar character. They've basically tried to set out at various sizes to survey the career. The first of them was a show that Suzanne Delahanty did at Philadelphia in 1974. It's not a show I saw, but it was a show for which I bought the catalogue very early on and became very strongly aware of what Trombley was doing and began to understand, in my own mind, how his work had developed over the previous 20 years, having previously only seen single paintings in museums, not in this country, of course, but in continental Europe. Suzanne's show was 17 paintings, 28 drawings, 5 sculptures, quite a spare show. The next show was a show done by David Whitney at the Whitney Museum in 1979. That was a slightly larger show. It had 35 paintings, some drawings. It included the famous Commodus series. It was a show that was almost universally disregarded by the critics and by audiences in New York, and had very little impact. It may have come at just the wrong moment. The catalogue, of course, contained of what is now a celebrated and really insightful essay by Roland Barthes, but otherwise the show was not a great success. In 87, Harold Zeman did a show which travelled in Europe. It began in Madrid and Zurich. It came to the Whitechapel. I had been involved with Harry in the early stages of the show and was involved in trying to set up the terms in which the show was done. But I rather bowed out. I think that small plants don't grow under great trees, and Harry had... was clearly in the saddle on the show, and he produced a very beautiful show with some 42 paintings, some 50 or 60 drawings, and about 19 sculptures. And it was in that show that for the first time in the late 80s that sculpture was brought in to the exhibitions of Trombley's work in a serious way. The great retrospective that Kirk Varnado did at the Museum of Modern Art in 1994 was a show of more or less about 120 objects with only 3 sculptures or 4 sculptures, just the early sculptures that you've seen there, plus 1 or 2 later sculptures. very, very few sculptures. It was a show principally of painting, and very much focused on the 50s and 60s, not looking very much at the 70s, 80s, and indeed the 90s, although the show did conclude with the first of the four-season cycle. In 2000, Katharina Schmidt did a really comprehensive, beautiful, and remarkable survey of Twombly sculpture, accompanied by a really insightful catalogue. And so, coming to the idea of creating a new show for Twombly here in London, and then to go to Bilbao and Rome, the issues for us really were, does one simply try to do another survey show of Twombly's work, or do you try to find another way of approaching this artist who has been extraordinarily prolific, but in great waves, not consistently so, but has worked, as I've suggested, really in painting, sculpture and drawing at different moments in the career. And I think one has to remember that all exhibitions are, in one sense or another, theatre. I would say that they also need to have an argument, but they're not a book and they're not an essay. They are take place very much in a space, and they need to be constructed with regard to that space. Here at the Tate, over the past 10 years or so, in approaching the shows that we've been conceiving, we've begun to try and move away from simply doing the standard, either monographic or at least survey exhibition, which does nothing more than simply set out the career. You would have observed, for instance, that rather than doing a Duchamp show recently, we put together Duchamp, Man Ray, Picabia. Rather than doing an Albers show or a Moholy-Nage show, we put together Albers and Moholy-Nage, and drew out of those comparisons and connections, I believe, insights that would not have been available simply through the monographic show. I think it's one of the tasks of an institution like this at the beginning of the 21st century to rethink the way in which we do exhibitions, and not simply to trot out, you know, another 50 paintings by Matisse as the Matisse show, or another 100 paintings by Picasso as the Picasso show. It's why we did Picasso-Matisse in 2002-03. I think these kinds of shows where one simply sees a monographic display without any kind of argument other than simply laying out the career should, in my mind, really be something which perhaps the smaller institutions have to do, but we at the Tate ought to be constructing shows that have a stronger argument than that. And therefore, in conceiving of this show and trying to think about how one could cover the career, I began to think about the way in which Twombly himself works, the fact that he's often worked, as I've suggested, in these groups, in these cycles, and began then to plan out the show on the basis of a series of rooms that would be devoted to painting, sometimes sculpture or drawing, but each time looking at a very concentrated group of work with the sense, with the intention really of giving that sense of how Twombly himself had been in the studio working on a group, struggling with it, and eventually producing the works that we've seen today. There are, of course, when you come to make any show of this kind, certain constraints and limitations. In the case of the Tate here, there's the limitation of space. It may seem as though we have a huge amount of space, but indeed, with only 1,100 square meters, it's not a great deal of space to cover 60 years of work. I wanted to show all three media, which meant painting, sculpture, and drawing, which meant that there were groups of painting that we could certainly not include if we were going to show sculpture. I wanted to try and work very closely with Twombly in the selection, and that, of course, brings with it certain constraints. Working with a living artist is completely different from working with an artist who is dead. He has his prejudices, he has his interests, he has his, in most instances, in my experience, total commitment to the recent work and considerable disinterest in the early work. In the case of Twombly, that wasn't quite the case. I think one of the things that really intrigued him about the structure for the show that we conceived was the notion of bringing back together groups that he had not seen for many, many, many years. And it was the principal argument that we deployed with that other constraint, the lenders or the owners, when we were trying to argue that works should travel, fragile works should travel from Houston or from Cologne or elsewhere to be here and be reunited or seen together for the first time ever. Another constraint was the fact that, as many of you will be aware, Cy himself has placed a very large group of works, which many of which he owns, in the Dominion Museum in Houston, in a pavilion designed by Renzo Piano. And that is in itself a very beautiful and compelling and complete account of his work. And an issue for me, at least, was should we disrupt that complete and compelling account of Twombly's work by taking works, paintings out of every room throughout that pavilion? Or should we try to find another way that did not disrupt the experience of visitors to Houston for a period of more than 12 months? And that's one of the reasons why I came to the conclusion that we should include the group of green paintings, taking out one room from that display and leaving the rest intact. The spaces at Tate Modern lend themselves to being used in particular ways. There is this great sense, as you move in through the exhibition, the entrance to the exhibition, of the possibility, at least, almost the necessity of moving through a series of enfilade galleries. And that, although we disrupted the enfilade, and the enfilade and the simplicity of the enfilade plan is something which actually appeals very much to Twombly himself. When you visit him in Rome and you see him living in Via Monserrato in this classical building where all the doors are aligned, and you've probably seen this in the photographs of his house in Rome, and the light coming in through the windows at the side, you have this sense of calm classicism that I think is certainly one of the principles on which museum spaces have been organized historically from Schinkel onwards. So we definitely wanted to start with a sense of that progression to give people a way into the work. And indeed, really, from the early 50s, I would say through to the late 60s, Twombly's work does move forward in a fairly steady, and if not logical, at least continuous process. But as you turn the corner in the show, and as you move into the second half of the show, we also wanted to open out the space and to give that sense that one has in his work of him beginning to explore simultaneously different possibilities and different ways of working, so that you move into the room of sculpture and then have a diagonal movement through the space into the 80s and another diagonal movement back into the 90s. And in that way, you have this sense that here is a man who has reached a certain maturity and can indeed move in many different directions at any given moment. A further, and in a way, encouragement to me to think in terms of making a show with this kind of structure was that I have in the past made shows that have been moderately successful, that have looked at single bodies of work rather longer ago than I now care to remember. In 1980, I made a show at the Whitechapel that brought together all but one of the triptychs that had been painted by Max Beckmann between 1933 and his death. I did a show on the late work of Leger, also at the Whitechapel. And just as I was leaving, we did a show on Miro in the 30s. And it was my experience of making those shows that that kind of concentrated attention to a small period or body of work was very much more revealing than simply a kind of skimming of the surface, looking across the whole career. I mentioned earlier that, of course, there were painful moments in making this show, or at least I mentioned that there were omissions, and those were certainly painful. 50 Days at Ilium is a cycle of work which should be in this show. It sits in Philadelphia. I think I could have persuaded them to lend it, but it would have been at the expense, probably, of a group of paintings which I think are probably less successful, but I think a necessary part of the Twombly story, namely the green paintings. I would have loved to have shown the discourse on Commodus. The Orion series, the further paintings in on the theme of Orpheus, or as you come to the turn of the century, around about 2000, the coronation of Sesostris, those paintings which some of you may have seen in Venice 2 years ago in François Pinault's collection at the Palazzo Grassi, or the winter paintings that were seen at Gagosian here in London about 3 years ago. I would like to have shown more sculpture, and until just a couple of weeks before the show opened, it seemed possible that there would be a whole new group of paintings on which Twombly has been working through this spring, a glimpse of which can be seen in the catalogue. Sadly, the paintings are not yet quite complete, but they are four or five paintings, triptychs, or indeed a single canvas that is 30 foot wide. Those will come, perhaps, and join the show in Bilbao, or possibly be seen elsewhere later in the year. I think that for any show, the catalogue should be and is an integral part. And in the case of this exhibition, we set out to do a number of things. I was incredibly fortunate about a year and a half ago to be joined here at the Tate by Nick Cullinan, who had been working on Twombly's Commodus series in a catalogue note that he had prepared while he was an intern at the Guggenheim. And he was also working on an essay on Rauschenberg and Twombly, fruits of which will be published in the Burlington Magazine in July. And together we developed thoughts about the way in which this catalogue would be structured. There had to be a comprehensive bibliography, and Krzysztof Czachowski and his colleagues in the Tate Library produced that. It's amazing how, if you look back in even some of the so-called authoritative catalogues, they basically reprint the gallery, commercial gallery, bibliographies, which are often full of errors. And one of the things that the Tate tries to do with these shows is to produce a comprehensive and satisfactory bibliography. Nick put together, from many sources and discussion, and in discussion with Cy, what is the most complete chronology, probably as complete as Cy will ever allow, of his work over a 60-year period. Richard Schiff responded to our invitation to contribute an essay which is as insightful as many of his other essays, some of which we've had the privilege of publishing. And as Nick mentioned a moment ago, Tacita Dean, who had seen the show at the Whitechapel and who had talked about Twombly and Deer, agreed to write a short essay with her reflections on Twombly, and clearly alluding to the ways in which Twombly's own vision has affected hers. Nick has produced a series of short essays on each of the groups, which I think stand in comparison with the writing that Kurt Varnadeau did 15 years ago on the early work, and carry through the story of Twombly's evolution, but also the way in which he digs deep into individual subjects by looking at each of the groups in the show. And then finally there is an interview with Trombley. It was extremely difficult to get him to agree to talk. It was even more difficult to get him to agree that it should be published once he'd seen it on the page, because he speaks in a southern drawl. He speaks elusively. He doesn't always complete his sentences, although the sense of what he is saying is very plain. But I felt it important to try and get down and publish and get down in writing many of the thoughts that he has conveyed to others and which appear in essays and in some of the earlier chronologies about the evolution of his work and his relationships with other artists and his motivation in going to Italy, for instance. I felt it important to try and get that down and recorded in his own words rather than simply as hearsay. And so that completes the catalogue. I hope you will enjoy seeing the exhibition later, and I'm looking forward to the rest of the conference. So thank you.
Good. I just want to begin by making one small general point about the illustrations or the images I'll be showing. I have never had so much trouble trying to get good images of an artist as I did when trying to prepare this talk, and it wasn't to do with the quality of the reproductions around. I mean, I think there's one fairly straightforward problem. Because Twombly so often painted on a white ground with relatively small, finely drawn inscriptions on it, you either get a white image, which completely wipes out all the details, or you darken it so it's not the same tonality as the painting and begin to bring out the details. But I think there's something more significant there. I think that his is a very interesting art in which there is no one way of looking at it. And as I was sort of trying to calibrate the brightness and darkness and saw different things coming into view, it is a kind of painting that you never see at all. You've got different ways of looking at it and different focuses on it, and each time the painting becomes something different. Begin with a quote. I think it's from that fabulous interview in the catalogue. "I'm not pure," says Trombley. "I'm not an abstractionist completely. There has to be a history behind the thought." Critical commentary on Trombley usually sees his move to Italy in 1957 as distancing him from the experimental initiatives that played themselves out in America and particularly in New York over the subsequent two decades. While there's some truth to this, such a perspective ignores the fact that Twombly, while becoming a bit of an outsider to the mainstream American-based art world, produced work that was as deeply rooted in the artistic, cultural, and ideological currents of his time as anything being done in New York. I'll be arguing here that the open, dispersed form of picture-making he developed, starting just before he shifted the base of his operations to Italy, has significant affinities with that of American artists such as contemporary American artists such as Rauschenberg, to whom, as we all know, he was very close in the earlier mid-1950s, as this photographic exchange testifies. On the left, a double exposed photograph by Rauschenberg, dating from 1952, Psy plus Blob Bob in Venice. And on the right, I think a particularly fascinating overexposed photograph taken by Twombly in 1954 of Rauschenberg's combine materials in the studio in Fulton Street in New York, where they were both working at the time. When Twombly invoked the classicizing art of ancient Greece or Rome or Renaissance Italy, and here you see his variation on Raphael's Triumph of Galatea, he reconfigured the painting, bringing out undercurrents that spoke very much to a modern sensibility. He was no historical nostalgist seeking to recover some lost historical aura. The title of the painting, Bay of Naples, for example, dating from 61, may recall countless classicizing images of an idyllically beautiful pastoral south, but the painting itself hardly conforms to this stereotypical imaginary. There may be hints of clear blue here on the left. its ideal connotations augmented by the geometric purity of the floating rectilinear form, and the painting may be pervaded by a kind of Mediterranean white light. Yet there are many elements disruptive of such Arcadian overtones, in particular the fleshy breast or bum-like motif on the top right, the dripping brown below reminiscent of feces, a scatological effect amplified by the yellow and brown smearing elsewhere in the picture. In the center, the passion flower, the inscription, is irreducibly ambiguous, poetic on the one hand, but also graffiti-like by virtue of the roughly drawn form surrounding it. Defenders of American-style painting might have seen in de Kooning's gestural action painting a full-blown modern American-style art to set against Twombly's supposed Europeanism. De Kooning's painting of a tree in Naples, you see on the left, however, has much more in common with the mythic image of Italy, and much less with the decidedly impure chaos of modern Naples than Twombly's work. This said, I should add, that Twombly was a great admirer of de Kooning, and for very good reason. I'm just going to try a bit of adjustment here. I don't know if I can do that. It's just, yeah. Like Rauschenberg, Twombly was experimenting with opening up painting to a radical dispersal at odds with formalist and window models of the integrated picture. There is in both a kind of assemblage principle at work, a sense of provisional, unstable, disrupted totality achieved through contingent interactions between the heterogeneous elements that seem to derive from different cultural registers. On the left is Twombly's painting, The Italians of 1961, and on the right, Rauschenberg's Rebus from a few years earlier, 1955. Admittedly, heterogeneity is much more immediately evident in the Rauschenberg. Painterly mark-making and dribbles are combined with a variety of generically different found items collaged onto the canvas. These include cutouts from newspapers, samples from a painting colour chart down here, and a reproduction of Botticelli's Primavera, and scribbled drawing. Some of it are by Twombly, which you see here, and some by Rauschenberg. Such as the word pony boys, which you see here, scribbled across the word pony boys, the name of a Vermont cowboy group whose music was very popular in the 1950s, scrawled across the news photo of a female candidate for state governorship on the left of the painting, an image that contrasts with the vaguely titillating image of a partly undressed woman on the right. In this work, his pictorial logic has more in common with the assemblages of heteronymous motifs and symbols in pre-modern, non-classicizing religious and allegorical art than with the unified, spatially coherent easel picture that later became the norm in Western art. A whole world is being evoked, one that encompasses a public sphere of chaotic modernity and a more private, individualized sense of things. It makes partial sense, like a loosely stitched together modernist or postmodernist narrative, or a baffling rebus, continually inviting while also frustrating interpretation. At first glance, Twombly's work seems to represent a radically different kind of picture making. Everything in it is hand drawn. Close inspection, however, reveals that this too is an open array of disparate motifs. Interspersed among the freely drawn and scribbled passages are schematic motifs, including grids and other geometric shapes, and arithmetic sequences of numbers, such as this numbering down here, Passages of freewheeling mark-making are punctuated by letters, such as the big A in the centre, and by words inscribed in block capitals, such as the Italians on what looks like a classicising tablet towards the top, and Roma up here on the top right. There are fragments of handwriting, the artist's signature on the top right, and just here, just a vaguely perceptible scrawled Napoli visible towards the centre. Contrasting with the relative clarity of the words and letters and numbers and diagrams of various loosely articulated graffiti-like sexualized motifs, some hastily scrawled hearts, such as this down here, a number of which are there, the luminous white breasts beside the outline of a penis-like thing halfway up the canvas on the right, pendulous breast-like forms beneath a crossed-out rectangle just below, as well as a drooping black penis with one red testicle floating beneath a mouth or vagina dentata highlighted in red beneath the big A in the centre. There are also more expansive elements suggestive of architecture or landscape, such as this curious screen-like structure and the mountain-like motif on the left-hand side. Crucial here is a broader distinction between the painterly expansiveness of the white ground and the cramped inscriptions here and there of scrawled motifs that, like the disparity between the drawing-like forms and the more sign-like scripted words and arithmetic ciphers, blocks one from apprehending the painting as a formally integrated whole. If it works as a whole, it works at another level other than pure painterly formal integration. The work calls for two irreducibly different kinds of apprehension, an expansive overviewing of the pictorial field and disrupting this, a pictorially disaggregating deciphering of distinct marks and signs. What are we looking at here? As Bart Attlee comment in his much quoted and a much noted passage, there is no recognizable representation of the Italians of the title, however closely we look, just as we'd be hard put to see in a work from the previous year called Sahara anything reminiscent of a desert landscape. The Italian Sahara. So I just want to see if I got this here. The Italian Sahara. Where are the Italians? Where is the Sahara? This is Bart. Let's look for them. Of course, we find nothing. Or at least, and here begins Twombly's art, what we find, namely the painting itself, is ambiguous. Nothing represents the Italians, the Sahara. There is no analogical figure of these reference. And yet, we vaguely feel there is nothing in these paintings which contradicts a certain natural idea of the Sahara, the Italians. Bart is often misinterpreted as insisting here that the painting and the title operate at two structurally different levels, and that searching for any visual reminiscences of the title in the paintings is beside the point. But this isn't quite what he's saying. Unlike many theorists who've invoked him, he never sought a rigorous exclusion of representational or analogical elements from the art he admired. Indeed, both the Italians and Sahara have a visual richness and suggestiveness that prompts us to keep scanning the indecipherable array of visual motifs and verbal interjections for some evocation of the ideas designated by the titles, as if we were following the meanderings of a mind not really focused on the subject at hand, whether the Italians or Sahara, but nevertheless, in some sense, engaging with it. What might these Italians be? Are they the mythic Mediterranean Italians of picturesque travel literature, or the more everyday modern Italians who inhabited the rapidly expanding metropolises of Rome and Naples designated in the painting? Fellini's film La Dolce Vita, that had such a huge impact when it came out in 1960, the year before Twombly painted as Italians, presented a very contemporary image of Italians caught up in urban decadence and ennui that might be playing a role here. The point, though, is not that the painting has any single meaning like this. Rather, it is that such associations inevitably flash up in one's mind because of the dispersed, free-floating kind of looking the work invites. It's a looking that cannot hold onto any one single perspective, but rather dilates between seeing a broad overview and honing in on a detail. It's restless, meandering, punctuated by pauses when some partly recognizable sign is encountered. As a German critic reviewing Twombly's work in 1963 commented, the small size of the individual gestures and splashes of paint across a relatively wide surface traps the roaming eye in a real labyrinth. The freely meandering and punctuated or arrested drift in Twombly's work has, I feel, striking affinities with the drawings that Joseph Beuys produced in such abundance in the 1950s and 1960s. And here I compare on the left an untitled painting drawing by Twombly dating from 1954, and on the right a drawing by Beuys dating from a few years later. And this is particularly apposite because Beuys, as you can see, has here actually also inserted some lettering. Twombly first established his distinctive way of working, white painted ground overlaid with drawing and paint crayon and pencil, the latter combining disparate registers of word and letter scripting and more conventional artistic drawing in a group of paintings he exhibited at the Stable Gallery in 1956. These included several that carried, but not all of them, rather unusual titles: Academy, Freewheeler, the work shown here, and a detail, Criticism, and the Geese. I think this is a good example of how you just can't get the balance right in these reproductions. All three of these paintings are shown in the exhibition. Unfortunately, Freewheeler isn't included. But Twombly recounted how he and Rauschenberg and Johns came up with the titles when the finished paintings were displayed in his studio in preparation for the show. The three of them apparently drew up a list of words and then assigned words from the list to some of the paintings. The anecdote is usually taken to indicate that the relationship between the paintings and the titles is entirely arbitrary, because Twombly clearly didn't have the titles in mind when he was making the works. This, however, fails to take account of something he shared with a number of his contemporaries working in a semi-abstract mode, and that was essential to his art and the ways in which it evoked meaning or content. Even with paintings such as Twombly's, where motifs were hand-generated, as distinct from being prefabricated, as in Rauschenberg's Combines, significance would often emerge in the process of recognizing this significance after the work's motifs had already been fashioned, a found significance that might be seen as all the more compelling for not having been expressly intended. The contingent associations that would enter the mind of someone freely pondering the significance of an array of motifs in a work that momentarily caught their attention were more in the nature of condensations from the cultural environment in which viewer and maker of the work were immersed than meanings imposed on the work by the viewer's or artist's intentions. Max Kosloff was getting at something like this when, in a perspicacious commentary on Twombly's work, I think one of the most interesting, published in 1967, he distinguished between Twombly's objectivizing mark-making and the privileging of inner creative process in action painting or surrealist automatic drawing with its pretense of evoking the unconscious. In his view, to quote, Twombly's myriad markings of oil, pencil and crayon, while shaped and scraped airily into each other, still pervade the look of a surface whose disfigurements had their own random history, external to any creative process. They did not have the personality belonging to an artist scratching his own sign language, so much as they indicated the taste of a man posing as their anthologist, end of quote. Academy is the most script-like of the four title paintings Twombly exhibited in 1956, differing in this respect from the evidently more Freewheeler, the other larger-scale work in the series, whose title suggests something of a beat alternative to academicism. Academy may be lettered, but it too has its freewheeling and also its blatantly cruder moments. In the centre, towards the bottom, the word fuck is clearly iterated, and above it here, a more irregular array of letters forming the sequence A-D-K-M-E-Y-A, a quirkily misspelled anagram of academy. Various other half-formed as well as fully formed letters scattered here and there include a reiterated arc at the top right, at the top and on the center right. The overall effect, however, is not just a blunt fuck academy. As Kozlov said of Twombly's work, the non-arty crudeness is rendered through a casual drawing that is actually quite fastidious in character. Criticism, where fragments of the work fuck make a reappearance, with the letters UK at the center top, and again less clearly in the very center, has a certain cramped scriptiness that distinguishes it from Freewheeler and also from the Geeks, which you see at the side, beside it here. The latter, the Geeks, the smallest painting in the series, is somewhat more whited out and in this respect more painterly than the others. And the drawing, not particularly freewheeling, is in places a little figurative. I think there's sort of slightly Picasso-like figurative forms swimming up on the right. One can imagine the three artists playing with their list of words, identifying with Freewheeler, then tempering this with a touch of geekiness, they were committed artists after all, and registering their contempt for the academy and criticism by picking out the slightly insulting graffiti. They were not assigning meanings to the paintings, but rather toying with the possibility that certain qualities they had listed might momentarily materialize in the confused arrays of letters and meandering and stroke-like lines. These paintings, dating from the years 1955 to 6, have a distinctive format in which odd words and letters take shape within a thicket of markings and strokes. The work produced in the late 50s and early 60s, such as a study for the presence of a myth you see here, operates in a rather different mode. Where words occur, letters and words are relatively freestanding motifs within an open array of elements, some recognizable signs or images, but errantly articulated, and some errantly articulated indecipherable markings. These works no longer recall pages of scribbling or writing, and instead have a certain affinity with views or vistas. This is not because of a new depth of field, but rather because of the disparity between the smallness of the motifs and the expansiveness of the white ground on which they are inscribed. One such painting, called View, which you see here, could be construed as a disaggregated vista, partly obscured by yellow smearings applied over the pencil shapes and texturings. In a statement published in 1957, Twombly singled out whiteness as something that, to quote, persists as the landscape of my actions. Elaborating on the significance that white ground had for him, he talked in the recent interview about its expansiveness and radical openness and dispersal of the pictorial field, the white ground creating a vista, the opposite of that construed by one-point perspective. A field of white, to quote, is not closed. I think psychologically it's like there's no beginning or end. Then the painting doesn't have a center. It comes in one side and goes out the other. I really apologize about this. This is the only illustration I could get with the horrendous book crack up the center. The word view conjures up the idea not just of a vista, but of an overview of things, a world view, as it were. This particularly comes to mind when faced with a work such as School of Fontainebleau, one of Twombly's larger, more ambitious paintings from the years around 1960. The image you see hardly does the work justice, but I can at least give you an idea of what it's like to let your eye rove over the surface, picking out details suspended in the expansive white field. Unfortunately, all the views are oblique. This is the only way I could avoid catching the reflections on the perspex that covered the painting. On the upper left, just below the inscription carrying the title School of Fontainebleau, And the artist's signature, Swy Twombly, February 1959, is the bracketed and crossed out word sunset, just below which is a prominent blue horizontal bar, and lower down again some numbered wave-like motifs, and lower down again, just here, the inscription Holy Swan, set between some vigorous black markings and a small enigmatic floating form, is the arced motif above it, and to the right perhaps an emblematic image of a swan in flight. Further down, in the emptier, more open space in the lower half of the painting, one catches sight of diminutive forms almost lost in the white expanse, several ship-like, as if one were looking out on a vista over the sea. To the right, amidst a flurry of numbered cloud-like motifs, is the circled epithet, How to Hold a Wing, while more towards the center, the different shapes that swim into view include a curious skull-like form. Going back to the first view I showed, one can see that the upper right of the canvas carried a multitude of motifs that have been whited out, as if dissolved in a burst of intense white light, while an explosion of heart-like, but also buttock-like scrawls below the large A at the bottom right. I have the whole painting, yeah. Thinking of this region of the canvas, carried a multitude of motifs that have been, these scrawls below the large A at the bottom, suggest a counterbalancing intrusion of fleshly sexual energy. So you have this sort of burst of light up here, and then you have this eruption of sort of fleshly energy down at the bottom. The painting is almost inexhaustible, not because of a secret meaning it might harbour. The associations it conjures up are too provisional and contingent for that, but because there is no end to the endless looking it invites. Now, sorry, I jumped the gun here. What school of Fontainebleau is being evoked? Patently not the herbivorous, earthy naturalism of the 19th century landscape school of that name. Much more likely is the mannerist school that flourished in the court of Fontainebleau in France in the mid-16th century, and its elegantly artificial, eroticized, and curiously unclassical re-envisioning of Renaissance classical imaginary. As someone whose first encounter with art history in the UK in the 60s was shaped by a fascination with mannerism prevalent at the time, School of Fontainebleau puts me in mind of a painting in the National Gallery, London, Niccolo dell'Abate's Death, Pursuit and Death of Eurydice, that was then seen as a paradigm of mannerist art. That Twombly had this particular painting in mind is, I think, pretty unlikely. However, I would still maintain that there are suggestive affinities with his work in the expansive panoramic effect, and the way this envelops the scene of sexual assault and death. Such effects are common in landscape-based mannerist painting. I also like the little Orpheus here sitting, plucking his harp in the distance. But what is interesting is when you look at the painting, instead of seeing a foreground and then a vista, you have this sort of interaction. You have a motif at the bottom and you have the vista, and the vista almost envelops the scene below. The possibility also came to my mind that the inscription Holy Swan might have been prompted by the famous poetic rendering of Leader and the Swan by the French Pléiad poet Pierre Ronsard, a literary luminary associated with the court of Fontainebleau and known for his sophisticated fusion of the classical and demotic. The swan and wing motif also recalls Mallarmé, a poet much admired by Twombly, but this is another whole story which I won't go into here. My main point is that the density and scope of Twombly's painterly effects, seen in conjunction with the specificity of a title, prompt one to conjure up aspects of an imaginative world associated with the idea School of Fontainebleau, even while being unsure if any would have been on Twombly's mind, consciously or unconsciously, while he was working on the painting. This, it seems to me, is to be true to the fundamental interplay between freewheeling openness and puzzling specificity central to Twombly's art. I'll finish by touching very briefly on Twombly's engagement with the literary and visual world of classical antiquity and of the European and particularly Italian Renaissance. School of Fontainebleau has a counterpart in several paintings of the School of Athens Twombly produced between 1960 and 64 that explicitly make reference to the famous fresco of that name in the Vatican by Raphael. One of these versions, not in the show, offers a particularly vivid reconfiguring of Raphael's conception, making the Raphael work seem rather more intriguing in my mind than the paradigmatic high classical work it is usually taken to be. Twombly sketched out a skeletal re-rendering of the classical architectural setting and then enlivened this with an eruption of vividly charged markings, the most striking of which is the large-breasted torso, female torso-like form surging up on the right beneath the inscription Roma. But are the rounded forms necessarily female breasts? They could also be inverted buttocks, which would make sense of the shit-lined brown smearings nearby. Whatever form it takes, this crudely anarchic outburst of fleshly energy might seem to be very much at odds with Raphael's grand panorama of the great philosophers of antiquity. Twombly's intervention, however, alerts one to something in the Raphael that usually escapes notice. If one crops out the soaring architectural framing and focuses on the lower register and the assembled company there, a rather more chaotic, crowded scenario emerges, activated by the push and pull of gesturing bodies and the close juxtaposition of disparate groups and the undercurrent of erotic homosociality suggested by the presence of several beautiful young men. Yet all the same, the painting is a classical academy. There is a book-like form on the left and an inscription to Apollo, thinking of this, and an inscription to Apollo up here, a little above. Twombly's evocation of the classical had a broad reach and extended to the epic of war in Homer's Iliad, which he reconfigured for a modern imaginary by bringing out the latent disjunctions and disorder in his classical source. In the central panel of the 1964 triptych titled Ilium, One Morning 10 years Later, he inscribed his own name up here amongst the names of Greek heroes from Homer's poem, Achilles, Ajax, and Patroclus in particular, scattered amongst the chaoses of X's and penis-like forms and less legible scrawls and smudges. He put himself, as it were, amidst the chaos of battle and the intense male bonding that are such key aspects of Homer's loosely structured narrative. It is as if something about the larger context in which Twombly was living prompted him to identify with the turmoil and devastation in Homer's recounting of the War of Troy, the devastation amplified by Twombly's title, positioning the imagined scenario at the end of the 10 years of conflict that issued in the sack of Troy and the death of many of the heroes whose names populate his paintings. The prospect of a Holocaust that might be unleashed were the Cold War to turn into a hot war, and recollections of the recent devastation of Europe in the Second World War were central to the cultural imaginary of the earlier 1960s, and were no less present for Twombly than they were for other contemporary artists such as Rauschenberg, in whose work the machinery and effects of war from time to time imprinted themselves. Thank you.